afternoon. It's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading. And we've been reading The Mountain at the Mountains of Madness by H.P. Lovecraft. But before we go any further, a word from our sponsors.
Braidwood Butchery, high-quality meats and old-fashioned friendly service. And they also smoke all their own deli range on the premises and are open 5.5 days a week. Braidwood Butchery, 137 Wallace Street, Braidwood, 4842 2472. A proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Braidwood Veterinary Surgery has been providing high-quality veterinary services to Braidwood and the surrounds since 1989. Their veterinarians have extensive knowledge of preventative and diagnostic health of all species, no matter how large or small. They're open Monday to Friday, 9 till 5, and Saturdays, 9 till noon. You can call them on 48 42 2697, a proud sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Holdfast Distillery is Braidwood's first distillery, located in the basement of Braidwood Hotel at 180 Wallace Street. Their products are made with Australian grain and are distilled in their specially designed still to produce clean and crisp products. They select the best botanicals grown in Australia or source from overseas, ensuring there is no compromise in their products. Call 0406 083 963 for opening hours. Holdfast Distillery, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you to our sponsors as we end the year and move into another year all too soon. Well, we've been reading H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness. And basically, we're at the point where they're starting to discover something very strange, like a subterranean network underneath very, very high mountains that they've just found in Antarctica. Remember that this was written around about early 1930s. So they're sort of talking about, well, shall we say, areas that had barely been explored. Who knows what might have been there? And of course, they have discovered that perhaps there are other creatures millions of years old who may or may not be still around. The mood undoubtedly served to aggravate my reaction to the bizarre mirage which burst upon us from the increasingly opalescent zenith as we drew near the mountains and began to make out the cumulative undulations of the foothills. I had seen dozens of polar mirages during the preceding weeks, some of them quite as uncanny and fantastically vivid as the present sample. But this one had a wholly novel and obscure quality of menacing symbolism, and I shuddered as the seething labyrinth of fabulous walls and towers and minarets loomed out of the troubled ice vapours above our heads. The effect was that of a cyclopean city of no architecture known to man or to human imagination, with vast aggregations of night-black masonry embodying monstrous perversions of geometrical laws and attaining the most grotesque extremes of sinister bizarrery. There were truncated cones and sometimes terraced or fluted, surmounted by tall cylindrical shafts here and there, bulbously enlarged and often capped with tiers of thinnish scalloped discs, and strange beetling table-like constructions suggesting piles of multitudinous rectangular slabs or circular plates or five-pointed stars, with each one overlapping the one beneath. There were composite cones and pyramids, either alone or surmounting cylinders or cubes, or flatter truncated cones and pyramids, and occasional needle-like spires in curious clusters of five. All of these febrile structures seemed knit together by tubular bridges crossing from one to the other at various dizzy heights, and the implied scale of the whole was terrifying and oppressive in its sheer giganticism. The general type of mirage was not unlike some of the wilder forms observed and drawn by the Arctic whaler Scoresby in 1820. But at this time and place, with those dark, unknown mountain peaks soaring stupendously ahead, that anomalous elder world discovery in our minds and the pall of probable disaster enveloping the greater part of our expedition, we all seemed to find it a taint of latent malignity and infinitely evil portent. I was glad when the mirage began to break up, though in the process the various nightmare turrets and cones assumed distorted temporary forms of even vaster hideousness. As the whole illusion dissolved to churning opalescence, we began to look earthward again and saw that our journey's end was not far off. The unknown mountains ahead rose dizzyingly up like fearsome ramparts of giants, their curious irregularities showing with startling clearness even without a field glass. We were over the lowest foothills now, and could see amidst the snow, ice and bare patches of their main plateau a couple of darkish spots which we took to be Lake's camp and boring. The higher foothills shot up between 5 and 6 miles away, forming a range almost distinct from the terrifying line of more than Himalayan peaks beyond them. At length, Ropes, the student who had relieved McTeague at the controls, began to head downward toward the left-hand dark spot whose size marked it as the camp. As he did so, McTeague sent out the last uncensored wireless message the world was to receive from our expedition. Everyone, of course, has read the brief and unsatisfying bulletins of the rest of our Antarctic sojourn. Some hours after our landing, we sent a guarded report of the tragedy we found and reluctantly announced the wiping out of the whole lake party by the frightful wind of the preceding day or of the night before that. 11 known dead. Young Gedney missing. People pardoned our hazy lack of details through realization of the shock the sad event must have caused us, and believed us when we explained that the mangling action of the wind had rendered all 11 bodies unsuitable for transportation outside. Indeed, I flatter myself that even in the midst of our distress, utter bewilderment and soul-clutching horror, we scarcely went beyond the truth in any specific instance. The tremendous significance lies in what we dared not tell, what I would not tell now, but for the need of warning others off from nameless terrors. It is a fact that the wind had wrought dreadful havoc. Whether all could have lived through it, even without the other thing, is gravely open to doubt. The storm with its fury of madly driven ice particles must have been beyond anything our expedition had encountered before. One aeroplane shelter, all it seems had been left in far too flimsy and inadequate state, was nearly pulverized, and the derrick at the distant boring was entirely shaken to pieces. The exposed metal of the grounded planes and drilling machinery was bruised into a high polish, and two of the small tents were flattened despite their snow banking. Wooden surfaces left out in the blast were pitted and denuded of paint, and all signs of tracks in the snow were completely obliterated. It is also true that we found none of the Achaean biological objects in a condition to take outside as a whole. We did gather some minerals from a vast tumble pile, including several of the greenish soapstone fragments whose odd five-pointed rounding and faint patterns of group dots caused so many doubtful comparisons, and some fossil bones specimens, which were the most typical of the curiously injured remainders. None of the dogs survived, their hurriedly built snow enclosure near the camp being almost wholly destroyed. The wind may have done that, though the greater breakage on the side next the camp, which was not the windward one, suggests an outward leap or break of the frantic beasts themselves. All three sledges were gone, and we have tried to explain that the wind may have blown them off into the unknown. The drill and ice-melting machinery at the boring were too badly damaged to warrant salvage, and we used them to choke up that subtly disturbing gateway to the past, which Lake had blasted. We likewise left at the camp the two most shaken up of the planes, since our surviving party had only four real pilots, Sherman, Danforth, McTeague and Ropes, in all with Danforth in a poor nervous shape to navigate. We brought back all the books, scientific equipment and other incidentals we could find, though much was rather unaccountably blown away. Spare tents and furs were either missing or badly out of condition. It was approximately 4 p.m. after Wide Plain Cruising had forced us to give up Gedney for lost, that we sent our guarded message to the Arkham for relaying. And I think we did well to keep it as calm and non-committal as we succeeded in doing. The most we said about agitation concerning our dogs, whose frantic uneasiness near the biological specimens was to be expected from poor Lake's accounts. We did not mention, I think, their display of the same uneasiness when sniffing around the queer greenish soapstones and certain other objects in the disordered region, objects including scientific instruments, aeroplanes and machinery, both at the camp and at the boring, whose parts had been loosened, moved or otherwise tampered with by the winds that must have harboured singular curiosity and investigativeness. About the 14 biological specimens, we were pardonably indefinite. We said that the only ones we discovered were damaged, but that enough was left of them to prove Lake's description wholly and impressively accurate. It was hard work keeping our personal emotions out of this matter, and we did not mention numbers or say exactly how we had found those which we did find. We had, by that time, agreed not to transmit anything suggesting madness on the part of Lake's men, and it surely looked like madness to find 6 imperfect monstrosities carefully buried upright in 9-foot snow graves under 5-pointed mounds punched over with groups of dots in patterns exactly like those on the queer greenish soapstone dug up from Mesozoic or tertiary times. The 8 perfect specimens mentioned by Lake seemed to have been completely blown away. We were careful, too, about the public's general peace of mind. Hence, Danforth and I said little about that frightful trip over the mountains the next day. It was the fact that only a radically lightened plane could possibly cross a range of such height, which mercifully limited the scouting tour to the two of us. On our return at 1 a.m, Danforth was close to hysterics, but kept an admirably stiff upper lip. It took no persuasion to make him promise not to show our sketches and the other things we brought away in our pockets, not to say anything more to the others than we had agreed to relay outside, and to hide our camera films for private development later on. So that part of my present story will be as new to Parbody, McTeague, Ropes, Sherman and the rest as it will be to the world in general. Indeed, Danforth is closer mouthed than I, for he saw, or thinks he saw, one thing he will not tell, even me. As all know, our report included a tale of a hard ascent, a confirmation of Lake's opinion that the great peaks are of Achaean slate and other very primal crumpled strata, unchanged since at least Middle Comanchean times. A conventional comment on the regularity of the clinging cube and rampart formations, a decision that the cave mouths indicate dissolved calcareous veins, a conjecture that certain slopes and passes would permit of the scaling and crossing of the entire range by seasoned mountaineers, and a remark that the mysterious other side holds a lofty and immense super plateau, as ancient and unchanging as the mountains themselves, 20,000 feet in elevation, with grotesque rock formations protruding through a thin glacial layer and with low gradual foothills between the general plateau surface and the sheer precipices of the highest peaks. This body of data is in every respect true, so far as it goes, and it completely satisfied the men at the camp. We laid our absence of 16 hours, a longer time than our announced flying, landing, reconnoitring and rock-collecting program called for, to a long mythical spell of adverse wind conditions, and told truly of our landing on the farther foothills. Fortunately, our tale sounded realistic and prosaic enough not to tempt any of the others into emulating our flight. Had any tried to do that, I would have used every ounce of my persuasion to stop them. And I do not know what Danforth would have done. While we were gone, Parbody, Sherman, Ropes, McTeague and Williamson had worked like beavers over Lake's 2 best planes, fitting them again for use despite the altogether unaccountable juggling of their operative mechanism. We decided to load all the planes the next morning and start back for our old base as soon as possible. Even then, though indirect, That was the safest way to work toward McMurdo Sound. For a straight line flight across the most utterly unknown stretches of the Eon Dead continent would involve many additional hazards. Further exploration was hardly feasible in view of our tragic decimation and the ruin of our drilling machinery, and the doubts and horrors around us, which we did not reveal, made us wish only to escape from this austral world of desolation and brooding madness as swiftly as we could. As the public knows, our return to the world was accomplished without further disasters. All planes reached the old base on the evening of the next day, January 27th, after a swift non-stop flight, and on the 28th we made McMurdo Sound in two laps, the one pause being very brief and occasioned by a faulty rudder in the furious wind over the ice shelf after we had cleared the Great Plateau. In 5 days more, the Arkham and Miskatonic, with all hands and equipment on board, were shaking clear of the thickening ice field and working up Ross Sea with the mocking mountains of Victoria Land looming westward against a troubled Antarctic sky and twisting the wind's wails into a wide-ranged musical piping which chilled my soul to the quick. Less than a fortnight later, we left the last hint of polar land behind us and thanked heaven that we were clear of a haunted, accursed realm where life and death, space and time, have made black and blasphemous alliances in the unknown epochs since matter first writhed and swam on the planet's scarce cooled crust. Since our return, we have all constantly worked to discourage Antarctic exploration and have kept certain doubts and guesses to ourselves with splendid unity and faithfulness. Even young Danforth, with his nervous breakdown, has not flinched or babbled to his doctors. Indeed, as I have said, there is one thing he thinks he alone saw, which he will not tell even me, though I think it would help his psychological state if he would consent to do so. It might explain and relieve much, though perhaps the thing was no more than the delusive aftermath of an earlier shock. That is the impression I gather after those rare, irresponsible moments when he whispers disjointed things to me, things which he repudiates vehemently as soon as he gets a grip on himself again. It will be hard work deterring others from the Great White South, as some of our efforts may directly harm our cause by drawing inquiring notice. We might have known from the first that human curiosity is undying and that the results we announced would be enough to spur others ahead on the same age-long pursuit of the unknown. Lake's reports of those biological monstrosities had aroused naturalists and paleontologists to the highest pitch, though we were sensible enough not to show the detached parts we had taken from the actual buried specimens, or our photographs of those specimens as they were found. We also refrained from showing the more puzzling of the scarred bones and greenish soapstones, while Danforth and I have closely guarded the pictures we took or drew on the super plateau across the range and the crumpled things we smoothed, studied in terror, and brought away in our pockets. But now that Starkweather Moore Party is organising, and with a thoroughness far beyond anything our outfit attempted, if not dissuaded, they will get to the innermost nucleus of the Antarctic and melt and bore till they bring up that which may end the world we know. So I must break through all reticences at last, even about that ultimate nameless thing beyond the mountains of madness. Chapter 4. It is only with vast hesitancy and repugnance that I let my mind go back to Lake's camp and what we really found there, and to the other thing beyond the frightful mountain wall. I am constantly tempted to shirk the details and to let hints stand for actual facts and ineluctable deductions. I hope I have said enough already to let me glide briefly over the rest, that is, of the horror at the camp. I have told of the wind-ravaged terrain, the damaged shelters, the disarranged machinery, the varied uneasiness of our dogs, the missing sledges and other items, the deaths of men and dogs, the absence of Gedney, and the six insanely buried biological specimens strangely sound in texture for all their structural injuries from a world 40 million years dead. I do not recall whether I mentioned that upon checking up the canine bodies, we found one dog missing. We did not think much about that till later. Indeed, only Danforth and I have thought of it at all. The principal things I have been keeping back relate to the bodies and to certain subtle points which may or may not lend a hideous and incredible kind of rationale to the apparent chaos. At the time, I tried to keep the men's minds off those points, for it was so much simpler, so much more normal, to lay everything to an outbreak of madness on the part of some of Lake's party. From the look of things, that Damon Mountain wind must have been enough to drive any man mad in the midst of this centre of all earthly mystery and desolation. The crowning abnormality, of course, was the condition of the bodies, men and dogs alike. They had all been in some terrible kind of conflict, and were torn and mangled in fiendishly and altogether inexplicable ways. Death, so far as we could judge, had in each case come from strangulation or laceration. The dogs had evidently started the trouble, for the state of their inbuilt corral bore witness to its forcible breakage from within. It had been set some distance from the camp because of the hatred of the animals for those hellish Achaean organisms, but the precaution seemed to have been taken in vain. When left alone in that monstrous wind, behind flimsy walls of insufficient height, they must have stampeded, whether from the wind itself or from some subtle, increasing odour, admitted by the nightmare specimens. One could not say. Those specimens, of course, had been covered with a tent cloth, yet the low Antarctic sun had beat steadily upon that cloth, and Lake had mentioned that solar heat tended to make the strangely sound and tough tissues of the things relax and expand. Perhaps the wind had whipped the cloth from over them and jostled them about in such a way that their more pungent olfactory qualities became manifest despite their unbelievable antiquity. But whatever had happened, it was hideous and revolting enough. Perhaps I had better put squeamishness aside and tell the worst at last, though with a categorical statement of opinion based on the first-hand observations and most rigid deductions of both Danforth and myself, that the then-missing Gedney was in no way responsible for the loathsome horrors we found. I have said that the bodies were frightfully mangled. Now I must add that some were incised and subtracted from in the most curious, cold-blooded and inhuman fashion. It was the same with dogs and men. All the healthier, fatter bodies, quadrupedal or bipedal, had their most solid masses of tissue cut out and removed as by a careful butcher, and around them was a strange sprinkling of salt taken from the ravaged provision chests on the plains, which conjured up the most horrible associations. The thing had occurred in one of the crude aeroplane shelters from which the plane had been dragged out, and subsequent winds had effaced all tracks which could have supplied any plausible theory. Scattered bits of clothing, roughly slashed from the human incision subjects, hinted no clues. It is useless to bring up the half impression of certain faint snow prints in one shielded corner of the ruined enclosure, because that impression did not concern human prints at all, but was clearly mixed up with the talk of fossil prints which poor Lake had been giving throughout the preceding weeks. One had to be careful of one's imagination in the lee of those overshadowing mountains of madness. As I have indicated, Gedney and one dog turned out to be missing in the end. When we came on that terrible shelter, we had missed two dogs and two men, but the fairly unharmed dissecting tent, which we entered after investigating the monstrous graves, had something to reveal. It was not as Lake had left it. For the covered parts of the primal monstrosity had been removed from the improvised table. Indeed, we had already realised that one of the six imperfect and insanely buried things we had found, the one with the trace of a peculiarly hateful odour, must represent the collected sections of the entity which Lake had tried to analyse. On and around that laboratory table were strewn other things, and it did not take long for us to guess what those things were. The carefully, though oddly and inexpertly dissected parts of one man and one dog. I shall spare the feelings of survivors by omitting mention of the man's identity. Lake's anatomical instruments were missing, but there were evidence of their careful cleansing. The gasoline stove was also gone, though around it we found a curious litter of matches. We buried the human parts beside the other 10 men, and the canine parts with the other 35 dogs. Concerning the bizarre smudges on the laboratory table and on the jumble of roughly handled, illustrated books scattered near it, we were much too bewildered to speculate. This formed the worst of the camp horror, but other things were equally perplexing. The disappearance of Gedney, the one dog, the 8 uninjured biological specimens, the 3 sledges, and certain instruments, illustrated technical and scientific books, writing materials, electric torches and batteries, food and fuel, heating apparatus, spare tents, fur suits and the like, was utterly beyond sane conjecture, as were likewise the spatter-fringed ink blots on certain pieces of paper and the evidences of curious alien fumbling and experimentation around the planes and all other mechanical devices, both at the camp and at the boring. The dogs seemed to abhor this oddly disordered machinery. Then, too, there was the upsetting of the larder, the disappearance of certain staples, and the jarringly comical heap of tin cans pried open in the most unlikely ways and at the most unlikely places. The profusion of scattered matches, intact, broken or spent, formed another minor enigma, as did the 2 or 3 tent cloths and fur suits which we found lying about with peculiar and unorthodox slashings, conceivably due to clumsy efforts at unimaginable adaptions. The maltreatment of the human and canine bodies and the crazy burial of the damaged Archaean specimens were all of a piece with this apparent disintegrative madness. In view of just such an eventuality as the present one, we carefully photographed all the main evidences of insane disorder at the camp, and shall use the prints to buttress our pleas against the departure of the proposed Starkweather Moor expedition. Our first act, after finding the bodies in the shelter, was to photograph and open the row of insane graves with the 5-pointed snow mounds. We could not help noticing the resemblance of these monstrous mounds with their clusters of grouped dots to poor Lake's description of the strange greenish soapstones, and when we came on some of the soapstones themselves in the great mineral pile, we found the likeness to be very close indeed. The whole general formation, it must be made clear, seemed abominably suggestive of the starfish head of the Achaean entities, and we agreed that the suggestion must have worked potently upon the sensitized mind of Lake's overwrought party. Our own first sight of the actual buried entities formed a horrible moment and sent the imaginations of Parbody and myself back to some of the shocking primal myths we had read and heard. We all agreed that the mere sight and continued presence of the things must have cooperated with the oppressive polar solitude and Damon Mountain wind in driving Lake's party mad. For madness, centering in Gedney, was the only possible surviving agent. Was the explanation spontaneously adopted by everybody, so far as spoken utterance was concerned, though I will not be so naive as to deny that each of us may have harboured wild guesses which sanity forbade him to formulate completely. Sherman, Parbody and McTighe made an exhaustive aeroplane cruise over all the surrounding territory in the afternoon, sweeping the horizon with field glasses in quest of Gedney and of the various missing things, but nothing came to light. The party reported that the Titan barrier range extended endlessly to left and right alike, without any diminution in height or essential structure. On some of the peaks, though, the regular cube and rampant formations were bolder and plainer, having doubly fantastic similitudes to Rorik-painted Asian hill ruins. The distribution of cryptic or cave mouths on the black snow denuded summits seemed roughly even as far as the range could be traced. In spite of all the prevailing terrors, we were left with enough sheer scientific zeal and adventurousness to wonder about the unknown realm beyond those mysterious mountains. As our guarded messages stated, we rested at midnight after our day of terror and bafflement, but not without a tentative plan for one more range-crossing altitude flight in a lightened plane with aerial camera and a geologist's outfit, beginning the following morning. It was decided that Danforth and I try it first, and we awaked at 7 a.m. intending an early trip, though heavy winds, mentioned in our brief bulletin to the outside world, delayed our start till nearly 9 o'clock. As I have already repeated, the non-committal story we told the men at camp and relayed outside after our return 16 hours later. It is now my terrible duty to amplify this account by filling in the merciful blanks with hints of what we really saw in the hidden transmontane world, hints of the revelations which have finally driven Danforth to a nervous collapse. I wish he would add a really frank word about the thing which he thinks he saw alone, even though it was probably a nervous delusion, and which was perhaps the last straw that put him where he is, but he is firm against that. All I can do is to repeat his later disjointed whispers about what set him shrieking as the plane soared back through the wind-tortured mountain pass after that real and tangible shock which I shared. This will form my last word. If the plain signs of surviving elder horrors in what I disclose be not enough to keep others from meddling with the inner Antarctic, or at least from prying too deeply beneath the surface of that ultimate waste of forbidden secrets and unhuman eon-cursed desolation, the responsibility for unnameable and perhaps immeasurable evils will not be mine. Danforth and I, studying the notes made by Parbody in his afternoon flight and checking up with a sextant, had calculated that the lowest available pass in the range lay somewhat to the right of us, within sight of camp and about 23,000 or 24,000 feet above sea level. For this point, then, we first headed in the lightened plane as we embarked on our flight of discovery. The camp itself on foothills, which sprang from a high continental plateau, was some 12,000 feet in altitude, hence the actual height increase necessary was not so vast as it might seem. Nevertheless, we were acutely conscious of the rarefied air and intense cold as we rose, for on account of visibility conditions, we had to leave the cabin windows open. We were dressed, of course, in our heaviest furs. As we drew near the forbidding peaks, dark and sinister above the line of crevasse-riven snow and interstitial glaciers, we noticed more and more the curiously regular formations clinging to the slopes, and thought again of the strange Asian paintings of Nicholas Roerich. The ancient and wind-weathered rock strata fully verified all of Lake's bulletins and proved that these hoary pinnacles had been towering up in exactly the same way since a surprisingly early time in Earth's history, perhaps over 50 million years. How much higher they had once been, well, it was futile to guess, but everything about this strange region pointed to obscure atmospheric influences, unfavourable to change and calculated to retard the usual climatic processes of rock disintegration. But it was the mountainside tangle of regular cubes, ramparts and cave mouths which fascinated and disturbed us the most. I studied them with a field glass and took aerial photographs while Danforth drove and at times relieved him at the controls. Though my aviation knowledge was purely an amateur's, in order to let him use the binoculars, we could easily see that much of the material of the things was a lightish Archean quartzite, unlike any formation visible over broad areas of the general surface, and that their regularity was extreme and uncanny to an extent which poor Lake had scarcely hinted. As he had said, their edges were crumbled and rounded from untold eons of savage weathering, but their preternatural solidity and tough material had saved them from obliteration. In many parts, especially those closest to the slopes, seemed identical in substance with the surrounding rock surface. The whole arrangement looked like the ruins of Machu Picchu in the Andes, or the primal foundation walls of Kish, as dug up by the Oxford Field Museum expedition in 1929. And both Danforth and I obtained that occasional impression of separate cyclopean blocks, which Lake had attributed to his flight companion, Carol. How to account for such things in this place was frankly beyond me, and I felt queerly humbled as a geologist. Igneous formations often have strange regularities, like the famous Giant's Causeway in Ireland. But this stupendous range, despite Lake's original suspicion of smoking cones, was above all else non-volcanic in evident structure. Excuse me. Well, that's our book reading for today. As next Monday is Christmas Day and the Monday after New Year's Day, we'll be having a 2-week break from our book reading. We'll return to H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness in around about 3 weeks' time. I hope that all of our listeners have a lovely Christmas and that it can be as happy and pleasant as it possibly can be for each and every one of you, and that 2024 might bring us all a more ordered year than we've certainly seen this year, and maybe, just maybe, a world that's a little bit happier than it is now. Keep well, Braidwood, and have a very merry and enjoyable Christmas.